overkill or underkill Middle East and counterterrorism expert Anthony Pace uses research and analysis to trace the underlying causes of the Iraqi takeover of Kuwait in 1990, adding his own personal experiences to the events. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from somewhere, I believe, in the UK. Anthony Pace. Anthony, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining us this morning. Many of us will remember vividly the Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait in 1990. Took a lot of us by surprise. I remember waking up and watching it on the Sky News that very morning. But the warning signs were there.
Yes, they were, but they were ignored.
How so? What was the build up then? I mean, what was, for those who aren't familiar with the months leading up? Obviously, Saddam Hussein, the Iraqi dictator, had been making belligerent noises to Kuwait. What were his reasons or what were his justifications to going into Kuwait? And how did the intelligence services in both Washington and London miss those signs?
Well, the basic point is that Kuwait for hundreds of years was seen as part of the old Turkish Empire, a very, very distant part. But as far as Iraq was concerned, which was the successor nation after the First World War, Kuwait was theirs. And they tried to take it in 1961. They had another go a little bit later on. So it's always been a claim there. On top of that, Iraq had been in a long war with Iran. And during that time, Saddam Hussein believed that he had saved the Arab nation and that the Arabs, the rich Arabs down the Gulf, hadn't been grateful enough and weren't going to let him off the huge sums of money that he owed them. And lastly, he believed that the Kuwaitis were sucking out Iraqi oil from underneath the desert. And he was going for all those things. And nobody told him he couldn't do it, particularly the Americans. The Americans had an opportunity to stand face-to-face with Saddam, and instead of saying, don't step the wrong side of the picket wire or you're a dead duck, their ambassadress said, well, basically, we're not really interested in border disputes between Arab countries, which was giving him the green light. Saddam assumed that if he did walk in, people might protest, they might be upset about it, but they wouldn't do anything. And that was the situation in August 1990.
I mean, one of the things, of course, you mentioned the Iran-Iraq war. Iran was the absolute pariah state at the time. And in several quarters, sort of Iraq was seen as perhaps doing the West a favor by, you know, having a pop at Iran.
Well, that's exactly right, Giles, because Iraq was always seen as one of our thugs, as opposed to the other side's thugs. I mean, I've heard that expression used many, many times. Well, there are thugs, and they would do that, wouldn't they? Which is not very good foreign policy, in my view. I've always believed that foreign policy was to be given out accurately to other states, not sort of skated over. And that's what happened, really. The Americans pussyfooted throughout the early months of 1990 with the Iraqis and didn't make their position clear. In fact, I would say they didn't even know what their position was. So you had a situation in August 1990 where other things were going on around the globe. There were two or three crises around the globe which were attracting the press amongst anybody else, and nobody really thought that anything was going to happen in the Gulf. Well, it did.
And of course, I mean, a lot of people sort of skate over that. I mean, it almost becomes a sort of footnote in, oh, this sort of happened in the 80s. But the Iran-Iraq war was a particularly nasty and brutal conflict.
Correct. Yes. And it hurt both sides. A huge number of men were lost, and women, not to mention the bombing of the cities from both sides. So it was a horrid conflict. There was some good work done by the superpowers in trying to restrain the two. And I think at the end of the war, it was joint pressure on the Iranians, in fact, which brought the war to a close, that the Iranians were tired. The Iraqis were pretty tired, so they needed an excuse not to do any more fighting. And that happened. And that was at some point for rejoicing.
Mm. And, of course, so as you said, other crises were going on. So presumably Western diplomats and leaders thought, OK, well, that's that situation sorted out. Let's look elsewhere. And once again, as so often in this particular part of the world, you mentioned the Ottoman Empire, how you have links going back an awful long way, and it is very easy for Western diplomats and leaders and strategists to go, okay, well, fine, we'll just leave that alone for a bit and go look somewhere else. And then, of course, miscalculated, misread the situation, and we have the situation like we did in Kuwait.
Yes, and there is because there are so many crises in the world, it's not so much you become complacent, but you think you get your priorities wrong. The Americans were concerned about what was happening in West Africa, where there was a state which was out of control. We were concerned about what was going on in the West Indies, where the mafiosa and what have you were threatened to take over a particular island. We were sending frigates there and what have you. And then one shouldn't forget, we were right in the middle of the political crisis in the Soviet Union, where Boris Yeltsin had just resigned from the Communist Party and, of course, was going to become leader of the new Russian Federation. That was a complete sea change. Mm. And so people were looking at that. And so our people who were assessing what was coming in by way of intelligence and any other information, they had the information in front of them, but they just didn't think it was going to happen. They thought Saddam was merely saber-rattling. Well, of course, he wasn't, because he'd get away. People like Saddam, like Putin, if they think they can get away with it, they will. And we've seen that very recently.
UK has always had a very special relationship with Saudi Arabia. I mean, surely the UK was there not intelligence coming out of Riyadh saying, look, this is something you should be more concerned with, because obviously because of the religious differences between those various parts of the world. And oil, etc. Something kicking off in Kuwait would have ramifications for the whole area, and also de facto Saudi Arabia.
It's a very good question, Giles. One has to remember that, in the words of one senior British Arabist diplomat at the time, Arabs do not fight one another. Where he got that one from, I really don't know. But there is some truth in the fact that the Saudis thought they could manage Saddam, just as Chamberlain thought he could manage Hitler. Mm. The Egyptians, who were very much involved in the run-up to the occupation of Kuwait, they also thought they could manage Saddam. And they talked to the man, and he said, oh, I'm not going to do it. And they took him at his word. So there was a gullibility is certainly amongst the Arabs at the time.
Yeah, you'd think somebody like Fahd, King, who was
yes,
would have, and he was the most westward looking of the Saudi leaders, the kings that we've had. You would have thought he would have said, well, I think we ought to be a little bit careful with Saddam, but there you go, as the saying goes, I suppose.
Yes, and it's where you go from that there's the hope that it's not going to happen. There's also some animosity between the Sauds and the Kuwaitis. They've always had a difficult relationship. Not least because the Kuwaitis have always been very careful with their money. It's one of the reasons why they're rich. And very nationalist in their view. They don't see why they should be a client state to anybody. They're very proud people. So there was always a bit of animosity there. And there's one other thing that I've got no shred of concrete evidence, if that's not mixing up all sorts of metaphors. I do believe that somewhere in Washington, probably in Riyadh, there were people who said, well, if Saddam takes over a few hundred yards or a mile or so, which takes over part of an oil field, and he regards that as payment for the money, for the oil that's been sucked out from underneath the desert, well, if that happens, so be it. That was never going to be the case, in my view, because you do not put 100,000 troops in to the desert in the middle of summer, certainly not without secure logistics. And you do it, however, if you know that the secure logistics are in Kuwait City, where the Kuwaitis were sitting on 2 to 3 years of supplies, because the Kuwaitis' view was that sooner or later there would be a European war, and it was up to the government in Kuwait City to make sure that the people of Kuwait had plenty of food and drink for that time.
Interesting point, and I hadn't thought about that before, but if you've got 100,000 troops, because your lines of communication in any campaign are absolutely critical, as obviously everybody from Alexander the Great to Operation Barbarossa found out to their cost. And so so it wasn't going to be just a couple of hundred acres of
that was my view, but yeah. I'm sure that the Americans thought it might be the case and would have put up with that. My view was, and I was fortunate enough to debrief a couple of our embassy staff about 2 to 3 weeks before the invasion, who had actually witnessed huge numbers of Iraqi troops and armor coming down the road. And I sent all that back to Whitehall. That should have been enough to put everybody on standby. It didn't.
And of course, he would have to capture Kuwait City, because obviously he'd have to resupply his forces. And therefore that is going to be the main objective. And he does.
Within 3 hours, his tanks were rumbling down into Kuwait City. That's from a 2 o'clock starting point in the morning.
Yeah.
And he'd taken over the whole state by the evening.
It was a very worrying time. I want to talk about just quickly this BA flight that goes in now, because the invasion happens very, very quickly indeed. As you said, it's almost blitzkrieg, basically.
And yet
a British Airways flight with passengers on board, with stewardesses on board, and I don't know if we want to go into what happened to them, but it flies into Kuwait City, even though the authorities should know that there is, to put it mildly, a problem where they're going to land.
Yes, and it should never have flown. The previous evening, I had a meeting with the country manager of British Airways in Kuwait, and I warned him that he might get a flight through that night at 12 o'clock, but if the Iraqis were coming, they would come in the wee small hours of the morning. That's when invasions take place, and so he shouldn't bank on getting in a plane through the same time the next day. So I'd given him a very clear warning that things looked bleak. He went home, or he didn't go home, he went to his office and got his wife and children onto a plane, which was going out that evening. He then went home rather than staying at the airport, and he didn't get back to the airport until 3 days later. All this is known to me. And yet this same man was the one who stood up in a French court and said that I had given him exactly the opposite information. So there was that line. The other line is that British Airways obviously checked on the security before their plane left, and they were being assured by Whitehall that nothing was going to happen, that it was safe to fly.
There are all sort of rumours that there were sort of suddenly the passenger roster changed on the flight, and perhaps it was a situation where, you know, troops were or special forces were going to be. This was a way to get them into the country because of all the chaos that erupted when the flight landed, and these operatives slipped away. But again, what happened to the other passengers? You know, and again, I mean, you know, it's quite horrendous things happened to some of them. You know, they were able to slip away in the chaos as this BA flight landed at the Kuwait airport.
Well, you've put your finger on that too, Giles, because there are two motivations in me publishing my book. One is to clear my name, which is understandable, I think, after over 30 years of completely opposite being talked about in the press. But the other thing is because I have met passengers who survived so far. I've had conversations with a senior member of the crew. And it just struck me that I need to do something for those people because they've been suffering. And some of them still are suffering quite seriously from the aftermath of all that. And so that's my second motivation, if you like. I mean, I can just very quickly read you my book's dedication.
Of course.
It says, to all those who suffered from Saddam's cruelty, particularly the Kuwaiti hostages who were abandoned by the world and others who received no compensation for their sufferings. Now, I talk about the Kuwaitis specifically there because many Kuwaitis was snaffled by the Iraqis, taken north, and were never seen again. And the world did nothing about that. United Nations didn't step in and say, hey, you signed an armistice, Saddam, saying all hostages should be released. We got our airmen back. The Americans got their people back. But the Kuwaitis, something like 600 of them, were taken north, and they were found murdered later on.
Mm. You see, the thing is, as you said before, he was a thug, but he was quote unquote our thug, and it's easy for us to look back now because we know Gulf War Two, you know, his gassing of his own people, you know, the marshes, exactly, and we can go, oh, the man was a brute, a beast. We had to get rid of him, but at the time, we just thought this. We were fed the narrative that it was better to have the devil you know than something else, and have a second Iran type situation in that particular region.
That is a strong thread which runs through my book, that Amnesty International during the 1980s was putting in reports saying what fearful things were happening in Saddam's jails. The murder was being conducted on London streets even by his assassins. We've seen the same thing with Putin, and everybody thinks, oh, well, somehow we'll manage it. Well, it's not good enough. You have to stand up against people like that. We didn't do it against Hitler in the 1930s. We could have toppled him in 1936 when he invaded the Rhineland. But we don't do it. And we're now caught up in this huge, great conflict in Ukraine. And for the same reasons that we don't stand up to people.
You've called the book Overkill or Underkill. Presumably,
yes.
Why that particular title?
Well, because both of them ring true. Overkill, there have been times when we have moved in when we didn't need to move in. My first chapter is really to do with the 1961 crisis, when there was a threat from the government of Iraq at the time, about 2 weeks after Kuwait got its independence, that they would take over Kuwait. I put it under the microscope, and there was no real threat. It was just at the time, well, we've got an aircraft carrier around, and we've got a brigade of troops, we'll put them in there. But it's questionable whether we really needed to do that. Read the chapter, you'll see what I mean. So that was overkill in my view. Underkill is not moving when you've got the opportunity to do so. And the classic case for me there is the 1991 armistice, when we told Saddam to do this, that, and the other. His generals signed the armistice, but as you well know, an armistice is only a halt in the proceedings. It is not the cessation of hostilities.
When you look at how various Western governments have miscalculated, misread, or just been plain ignorant of the multi shades of grey that go on within, with history, with politics, with religion, in this particular region. And it has ramifications that you can go all the way from, you know, putting the Shah in Iran, that can, all the situation there, and that leads in one way or the other to the chaotic scenes we saw in Kabul recently, as recent as last year. I mean, do you think perhaps that Western governments need to get, or hopefully get a better grip of this particular region, so we don't have this history repeating or echoing itself, you know, for the next 100 years?
I think we have to stop making mistakes, Giles. The mistake in 1991 is that we didn't hold Saddam to account. As a result, he was allowed to carry on doing what he liked doing, which was hurting people. But if we'd stopped him in the first place in 1990, there would have been no need for the Americans to have to send a huge great force to Saudi Arabia, which annoyed Osama bin Laden, who felt that the holy places had been violated. He then swore to get even with the Americans because of that. Up until then, he was almost a client of the Americans. So what happened? He pulled the Twin Towers down and hit the Pentagon with suicide flights. So what happens after that? We invade Iraq, not Iraq, we invade Afghanistan. And so there we are. We go into a place, we went in two places, went into Iraq and got rid of all the forces of law and order, so it's complete chaos. And we went into Afghanistan with the intention of democratizing the country. It's not possible to do that. Again, we're trying to accord Western qualities, I won't say assets, but qualities, to a completely different culture without understanding it.
As we've done over the years, and as Westerns try to do in Southeast Asia, for example, in the 60s and 70s, and once again found wanting.
Yeah. I mean, at least during the Indian Raj, our officials out there knew the language and the customs. And you would have four British officers looking after a whole district of 20 million people. But they knew the people, and the people knew them, and they worked through Indians. And during the 19th century, apart from one or two things that you can mention, like the Indian Mutiny, but we did a good job there. But when you run out of people who can't speak the language, who can't identify with the local population, then you're on a hiding to nothing.
The book is called Overkill or Underkill. It's by Anthony Pace, who we've been speaking to this morning. Anthony, if people want to find you online, is there an official website? Where can they find you?
Well, probably the best thing is to go through my publisher, which is Guild Books.
And what do you hope that people take from Overkill or Underkill? What do you think hope they will learn?
Well, I hope somebody said that my book actually helped towards the understanding of the subject, of where we've been in that part of the Middle East for sort of 50, 60 years. I'm a historian. I do believe in cause and effect. And I think one of the problems with our present society is we take individual subjects like the Nazis or you name it, but then we don't connect them up. But there is a big connection. That's why my book doesn't just try to exonerate me, but it tries to show how we got where we were and that's down to August 2021. Where we go from now would be very interesting to see, but we're already there with the Ukraine.
Yeah, as the regular listeners will know, one of the things that I always say is that nothing exists in a vacuum, especially...
Correct.
The book is called Overkill or Underkill. It's by Anthony Pace. It will also be available as a virtual download from our own virtual bookstore. Anthony, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you this morning.
Well, thanks for having me.